Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today was a former artist at Bethesda on games such as Skyrim, Fallout 3, and Fallout 4. He has also worked on an awesome illustrated book, Marvel Anatomy, a scientific study of the superhuman, and has recently started a Kickstarter with his graphic novel, Quiet Level 1, that you can check out. I'll post the links in the description. I'd like to welcome Jonah Loeb. How you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here. And hello to all the Kiwis and others who are listening right now. Yeah.
Now, I was speaking about this before, but you've done a lot of interviews, so I've got to make sure that I switch this up for you, right? So,
sure.
Yep, you've got to be respectful of your time. So I'm going to start off with Alduin the Dragon, right? Because this is the art that broke you, right?
Yes.
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 So, can you walk me through that process and how it ended up breaking you? And, like, were you aware of how hard you were pushing yourself at the time? Or what was the process?
No. So, essentially, for anyone who doesn't know the one sentence description, I gave myself tendonitis working on Alduin the Dragon. So,
yes.
At that point, I'd been working really hard on Skyrim for a while. Working at these desks, kind of in the chairs where you kind of lean back a lot. You know, it's hard for me to envision working that way now because I'm, you know, old. And so trying to picture like how
you're
a body,
not that
like,
old.
Yeah, but I'm old enough to know that you can't slouch while you're working. You have to maintain good posture or you're going to
yes.
suffer for it. So I was working on Alduin, the world leader, the last boss of Skyrim, and it was based on the model of from the normal dragons, and we were using I was kind of modding on top of it and building it anew. So I was using the same fundamental structure, but the concept art for Alduin, which was fantastic, was kind of pitted and black and that kind of thing. And the more I started thinking about Alduin the World Eater and this kind of this dragon-like entity with this almost sci-fi tilt of it, like I imagined it like hurtling through space, you know, hurtling through the cosmos, you know, like looking for worlds to eat. Whether or not that was his lore, that like appealed to me as a vision, you know, space dragon, you know. And so I was looking at meteorites for a reference, and meteorites are iron and they are pitted, full of little pits and divots. And so the act of sculpting it took a long time and involved intense amounts of detail. And I was carving it all by hand, you know, doing everything by hand. And a dragon is a lot of surface area. They have a lot of surface area to a dragon. They got some very big wings and really long tails. And even though this thing looked like a meteorite, he also had to have segments and individual plates and that kind of thing. And so it just, I was working really hard. I didn't realize how hard I was working. And my wrist started hurting. And then it got to the point where I was making I was going from the high resolution detailed sculpt to the lower resolution game model. And I was trying to build the game model out. And so I went onto my mouse and I was just clicking, 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 dragging, double clicking, clicking. And I was kind of behind schedule as I was wont to do a lot back then. And I just kept pushing myself to the point where I was really hurting. And eventually, you know, I figured, okay, there's like 4 or 5 days of good work left and then I'm done with this. So I just have to put in the time and then I can relax. And I just pushed myself, you know, for a couple of days. And then nearing the last day, I just hit a point where I was like, you know what? It's late at night. I need to get this done by tomorrow. I think I can get it done by tomorrow if I just hustle. But my wrist really, really hurts. So I'm going to lie down in the theater here at Bethesda because we had a little theater where we do team meetings and everything. I'll get a couple hours of shut-eye on these seats. And then when I'll wake up before anybody else gets here. I'll go back up to my desk and I'll just put in 3 or 4 more hours and have this done by lunchtime, you know, and turn it in finally, you know, 2 weeks late. And I went back upstairs after I slept and I sat down on my computer and I touched my mouse and I was like, wow, I can't click one more time. This is so bad. And only then did I realize, oh no, I've done something serious to myself. And I ended up taking, I think, like something like 3 months of halftime, you know, two weeks off entirely. And then for the next 3 weeks, 3 months, I got like a special provision just to work half the time And I was going to physical therapy, and I was going to physical therapy like 3 times a week nearby, and I just wasn't really getting better. Or rather, I did get better, but it took me a long time to do. And that ended up being an injury that stuck with me for a while. I kind of beat it down for a while, and then I left Bethesda, and then moving up to New York, I found myself in a couple of years again in this position where it was unsustainable pain, and it felt like it just hurt really badly. And I've been going to physical therapy and all these things, and I just thought to myself, what is wrong with me? Like, what I'm too young to feel this kind of like agony here, and I'm doing too much to try to prevent it. I was icing it on the regular, which helped a lot, and I was going to physical therapy, which seemed to help, but not very much. And ultimately, it turned out to not be my wrist at all. I kind of figured out, which is another story, that it was my spine. And I went to a chiropractor. They took X-rays, and they showed me that between two vertebrae in my neck, which is where the nerves come out to the that run down through your arms to your fingertips, between two particular vertebrae, I had some undiagnosed whiplash. And essentially, you could see even on the X-ray, there was arthritic buildup between two of the discs in my neck. And so what had happened basically is I had been pinching the nerves in my arm, and which killed a great deal of strength in that arm. And when you don't, so then my other muscles, like my tendons in my wrist, were overcompensating to try to make this work. So honestly, after a couple of weeks of going to the chiropractor, it went away. And it basically hasn't come back since. If ever I feel
Oh,
that
that's good.
nerve, and yeah, exactly. And this all happened when I was like 27. I'm 41 now, and I've got, this, it's not an issue. It's not an issue that has followed me. So if ever I feel that weird pain in my wrist, I just go see the chiropractor, and then I'm better the next day. So that's a long story, but that's what happened. Aldo and the World Eater destroyed me. Yeah,
Wow, wow.
definitely.
And I, because I've seen a chiropractor as well for like problems in my neck. And I remember the first time I went. They kind of grab your neck and they click it, and it's really kind of it throws you off, right? Because you feel like you're kind of supposed to be dead, like because it's so it feels kind of violent how they do
Oh
it.
yeah, it feels like Hitman.
Well, I'm glad that you're better now. So
Oh,
I
thank you.
suppose
Me
it's something you
too.
just keep aware of, and like
Yes.
your posture and everything while you're working and.
Yeah. Totally. I watch my posture. I try to work out and make sure my core is strong. And I go to the chiropractor like once a month. This guy, I've been to a couple of chiropractors, but this one is brilliant. So I'm really into him. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you aware of
Yeah.
anyone else like that you've worked with that has had similar issues? Because I imagine it could be a big problem with anybody in or who's working in front of a computer where you're leaning over or might be hunched a lot.
I haven't had anybody have the exact same diagnosis, but I don't know how many people have tried. I mean, I had undiagnosed whiplash that, like, obviously I didn't, that had got untreated. But with that said, we work in an industry full of creative professionals who are at their computer all the time. And there is no doubt, especially the ones who are having problems in their wrist, there is no doubt in my mind that those are at least partially attributable to the way they're sitting, because you can really screw yourself, by sitting strangely. Yeah.
Now, I know when you worked on Deathclaw in Fallout 4, the horns were slightly inspired by the Balrog from the
Oh
Lord of the Rings
yeah.
films. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I want to know, and this might sound cliche coming from a Kiwi person, but how much of maybe Skyrim or any other parts of Fallout were inspired by those films? Do you know? Or is it just you with the Deathclaw?
I tend to pick up random references as I go through life. And so I think Lord of the Rings was certainly highly responsible for, Skyrim for sure. There's a lot of that Nordic influence. There's a lot of those like old ruins and strange monsters under the earth and things like that, elves, dwarves, what have you. But when it came to the Deathclaw, I was just trying to figure out an elegant way to integrate the iconic Deathclaw horns into the silhouettes, because the ways it had been done before, it just didn't feel right to me. The old pixelated version, it looked pretty cool, and they had a unique kind of curve to them. But they were based on the horns of a Jackson chameleon, and it just didn't like. totally worked for me. And then in my Fallout 3 version that I made, the horns there also were kind of thin and kind of, there's a lot of elements of the Deathclaw in Fallout 3 are kind of skeletal. I was trying to create a feeling of foreboding and I wanted them to look scary. And so there's a lot of elements of them that are very creepy and skeletal. But the more I started thinking about this perfect hunter-killer hybrid that is the Deathclaw, I wanted, you know, there's something, the difference for me between 3 and 4, among other differences in terms of like evolutionarily, like more feasible looking, et cetera, is also beauty. Is I think that because Deathclaws are this kind of immortal facet of the Fallout universe that are kind of like, they are the dragons of the Fallout world.
Yeah.
So you can have a creature with more hit points or this and that, you know, like the Myrlet Queen, whatever, but ultimately the commonly, like, you know, the dragon of the Fallout world is the Deathclaw. So this, for me, was important to give them a sense of beauty. And I also like to make things, artwork that is iconic. And iconic basically means you see it and you remember it. It leaves an impression on you. And a lot of that is conveyed by conveying a sense of personality that is that makes an impact, emotional impact on the audience. And a lot of that also comes down to simplicity, visual simplicity, something that's not too dense and complex, such that your mind kind of latches on to the essential forms, shapes, and colors. And so when it came to the iconic Deathclaw horns, I tried to keep the same general shape and curve of them. You know, they kind of bow out and then kind of come in a little bit and then out again. But I really worked to fuse it into the skull shape altogether. So there is elements of the Balrog that is kind of like a ram, you know? I thought, you know, and that's kind of that's got that kind of like demonic satanic like feel, right? Like the, you know, the four-horned ram or whatever it is, and which makes sense because it was a demon. But for me, I was thinking more like Balrog or like bull or something. And I was just thinking like, how do I make every inch of this thing a weapon, like some kind of weapon, and without making it redundant, because it's not a demon, right? And so I don't want to make everything sharp and all these different little, you know, like that's why even the plates on along this back, these like this crest of plates it has, is more like a stegosaurus. They're not spikes per se. They're more like skeletal plates kind of. And so I really focused on creating a very simple silhouette to those horns and kind of forming them so that altogether, counting the top of the skull itself, which is very plated and thick, it forms kind of like a ram, like a ram's head, but not even like a ram, but more like a bull kind of, where you should be able to picture the very easy picture of the Deathclaw putting its head down and running forward full stop into something head first. It's the same reason, for instance, I made the tail have all these bony plates in it, but no spikes per se, because I just feel like on a creature like the Deathclaw, it's redundant. This thing has like a 7-foot wingspan with like, you know, like 2-foot claws, right? Like it doesn't need more sharp claws and edges. That's even why like the teeth itself are not even that sharp. The teeth are not used for rending flesh. The teeth are used for just crushing bone, you know, because by the time it gets to the Deathclaw's mouth, like it's done, whatever it is, it's dead, you know, like, because it's been just completely eviscerated. So Balrog bull, simplicity, iconic. Yeah. I wanted to take something that was essentially part of the lore and legacy and look of the Deathclaw and really integrate it into a more cohesive shape that is kind of then imprinted on people's memory.
But you say iconic, but how would you know it's iconic? Like, because you're looking at it, right? You would know it's iconic because what makes it iconic is if other people like instantly click with it.
You're absolutely right. Except that I have been studying I have been studying for many years. What is it that makes things iconic? And I think that a lot of it does come down to those two elements I just named: a personality that feels believable, that feels real, that you see it and it sees you, and you immediately understand its intentions. You know, and it makes an emotional connection. That's half of it. But the iconic element really does come down to a very simple and recognizable aesthetic. You know, so for instance, there are lots of kaiju in movies, right?
Yes.
But a Pacific Rim kaiju is unmistakable from any other one. And that is because they all share a similar set of characteristics. Large external formations on their head or their shoulders, whatever, like almost like hatchets or battle axes or swords or whatever, kind of built into their body. They have these large gray hides, kind of vaguely reptilian in nature. You rarely get like a monkey version of a kaiju, except for when you do, it's plated, right? Like the gorilla looking one. But ultimately, what makes them iconic are the designs, the glowing patterns and designs that cover their body. These make the kaiju from Pacific Rim unlike anything else and completely unmistakable from anything else, in the same way that the alien or the xenomorph, it's all black. It's got a crazy looking silhouette with these pipes on its back and the long, long head and all that. And the mouth within a mouth, these things make it utterly distinctive from anything else. And so I have made lots of things using a lot of the same techniques that I hope to be iconic, and some of them hit harder than others. The Super Mutants, for instance, I love my work on the Super Mutants for Fallout 4. They don't get a lot of love. You know, people don't usually do fan art for them. They don't really jump to the top of the list of anyone's favorite work. I love them. I'm obsessed with them. It is what it is. But with something like the Deathclaw, I worked real hard on that. And I think focusing on, when I say also the beauty of it, I don't mean the, oh, it's so pretty like a cat, you know?
Yeah.
But do you know that like the tiger burning bright in the darkness of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame its fearful symmetry or something like that? I like that poem, except it drives me nuts because it doesn't rhyme at the end there. but the fearful symmetry, I think, is kind of important, where symmetry is in many ways the root of attraction. The underlying current of like, does a person look good or not? The objective measure of that, the most easy objective measure of that, is how symmetrical is their face? It seems strange, but that's often a denoter of beauty. So there's something, if you can create bold, dramatic lines and forms, and kind of that really kind of balance well with each other. And that's kind of one of those things that you learn over time, like working on an asset and working on sculpture, et cetera. Then it kind of burns into people's minds, especially when you couple that with an emotional connection. So in answer to your question, yeah, like it's not for me to say it's iconic, but it's a form. The Deathclaw is a form I've worked with enough and have studied enough to kind of have gotten to the root, I feel, of like what makes those particular forms really feel, I don't know, maximized, you know, like, so for instance, and this will be my last example, because I know I'm going on and on, asked me about creature design. This is my jam.
Yeah.
In creating like the horn layout that is integrated into the skull, I was trying to focus on the large lines of the head. So so you could take with your finger and follow with your finger, you could draw a path across from one tip of the horn all the way around the horn, across the head and around to the other horn very easily, using very little wiggles and marks. So the power of that simplicity and the balance of those lines, you know, the Deathclaw's got a lot of scales and wrinkles and veins and plates and that kind of thing. But really, from my perspective, it's composed of very complete and very pleasing curves, lines, and straight lines. And it's designed to work that way. So when I draw, you can take a look at the Deathclaw from any different angle and kind of draw a line down across one crease in the neck, and it'll invariably hook into a plate on the side of the shoulder that swirls around to the back of the shoulder that then comes around to the front. You can follow these lines across the whole thing, in a kind of a sinuous manner. So I guess this is all my way of saying, this is how artists can bestow beauty on the terrible, is creating this completed line form and structure. I think it yeah. And when those things become irregular and mismatched and imbalanced, then things start really deviating into like the truly ugly. And that could be very useful if you want to create something repulsive, you know? I don't know if any of that makes sense, but there you go.
No, this is how, it makes perfect
welcome sense. To the inside of my head.
yeah. Well, this is why you are who you are, right? But can you watch a film or play a game and just enjoy it for what it is? Or do you put on your hat and start looking at it and be like, oh, that's not iconic. Oh, they should have done this.
yeah, I do sometimes. Only if it works both ways. If I see a whole bunch of missed opportunities, I get angry. Because then I'm like, come on, like millions were spent on this thing. And you're making these really silly choices where there was really so much room to do cool things, you know?
Give me an example.
I'll give you an example. Yeah. I saw bits and pieces. Maybe I saw the movie. I can't really remember because it was totally forgettable. But Aquaman.
And
they have, which is, you know, of course, it's an inherently like rather silly premise of these people, you know, these like Atlanteans living underwater, blah, blah, blah. I remember one particular scene where the bad guys are facing off against the good guys. And of course, the good guys have dolphins and seahorses, and the bad guys have sharks and things like that. And these, I remember the bad guys riding these sharks, and these sharks, like, kind of like they're kind of pulled back on their reins, and the sharks are kind of like lunging and snarling and, you know, like acting really fearsome and evil. And I thought to myself, absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong. There is nothing shark-like about that. That is a dog. That is not shark-like. And what they're doing is they're subverting the opportunity to make sharks fucking scary.
Right.
If they had one side, the seahorse and dolphins and all that kind of bucking and jittering, the prancing like ponies, whatever, and then you had the sharks just hanging there in the water with their hungry mouths, not snarling, not showing emotion, just have their mouths open and like gray gums with just teeth hanging there, that would have been cool. So lots of the tiny moments where that, where I'm like, if you just thought about this a little bit more, and instead of trying to impose like your vision on it, like let it do its thing. Yeah. Sometimes that drives me nuts, honestly, because it just seems like a missed opportunity. And then sometimes, and I see this a lot actually, because there's been a lot of great movies recently. I just sit back and wonder, and I know what they're doing and I love it. You know, I'm like, oh, I see what you're doing. Like, you know, the design for the sandworms in Dune. Like there's so many ways you could do a sandworm, and everybody wants to do a sandworm, but they look like giant, they're baleen like whales, which makes sense. And they look, when they rear up and open their mouth, they look like a giant human eye. I mean, that's iconic. You just nailed it, because what you've also done here is you've taken the sandworm, which, yes, it's an animal, but on the other hand, it's Shai Hulud. It's like a spiritual part of Dune, the planet. Like, it is a godlike entity. It is it is not just the defender of spice. It is made possible by spice. It's almost a magical entity, right? It's a biblical in nature and scope. So the fact that it's a giant human eye is just brilliant, you know? Or I watch Across the Spider-Verse and I see, oh, there's like compositor, there's 3D animators, there's graphic artists, everyone's working on this thing. And I think to myself, every moment of this movie is perfect. It's perfect. It's like thought out to a T. Every moment of every shot is thought out to a T. The dialogue is like tight, it's funny, and it's as twitchy as a spider. You know, it's just the whole thing. Like every Spider-Man you meet in that movie is funny. Why? Because Spider-Man is always funny. Yeah. And it's just... So yeah, I definitely like worked hard to like cultivate like a critical eye, because, you know, I believe it's important to like try to be critical with about a lot of media out there, because a lot of companies just want to spoon feed you crap, you know, and a lot of it is just derivative. But when I see things that are original, I derive like a real deep human pleasure, where I'm just like, bless you. Like, this is a gift to us all. Yeah.
Fair enough. Did you always get enough time? Like, obviously, with any character that you're working on or any piece of art, say when you're at Bethesda, like, I'm guessing you always had tight deadlines. But, like, how much time would it take you to just do one iteration? Because I imagine you did multiple iterations as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I was always given enough time. We were always in a rush, obviously. And I think some people were pushed harder than others. I think I was not pushed as hard as most people because I think I was not the most technologically savvy individual there. I wasn't doing, inventing new things and taking risks in any kind of big way like some people were. But I was doubling down or tripling down on just my artistic ability. And I think that I was given the privilege while I was there of designing a lot of the creatures there. And if you're a character artist, that means you love doing creatures by default. But I kind of, by virtue of having kind of learned some technologies sooner than others, ZBrush mostly, and kind of specializing in early in my career, I was given a lot of creatures. And it became, the more you do a thing, the better you are at that thing. And so I kind of just got to be that guy, which was amazing. And creatures take a while, and they take, I think the average creature would take me a month to sculpt and model and texture. And so I was definitely always hurried along, and I was always kind of a little bit behind, but I think I was given more leeway than most because I think the creatures are such kind of so important to kind of get right, because the players fighting them, So I think even when I drove my poor producer crazy, Angela, if you're listening, I'm really sorry. I love Angela. She was the best producer. But she had to develop a certain patience with me. And like, she kind of, I think she understood that I was given by default, like if I was, as long as I was doing things that people loved, nobody was going to come down on me too hard except for her. And she was like, damn it, Jonah. Like, this is, you're making my job hard. But I tried, and I learned a lot from her, and I learned a lot about the production process and just learning how to finish and move on. That's another thing that I learned while I was there is not everything has to be perfect because people are not really going to notice, little it, you make up your mind about a thing or assets or a creature or whatever really, really quickly, and the details from there are just gravy.
So would you submit, like, say, a piece of art to your lead, and then they'd be like, nope, go back and fix it or anything? Would that happen often?
Yeah, they would want fixes, they would want changes for sure. But I wasn't working in the dark for the most part. I was working on the concept art of, I was working off concept art, and so that would help a great deal. And I often would take chances, and sometimes they would like, I'd take chances in terms of I would change something. Because in my mind, I was like, all right, well, the concept art is just the beginning of the process, and like that's where we start. And like, yes, the concept artists will often work with the art director to generate like something ideal, but they won't always necessarily get there. And I think I was kind of, it was understood that I'd like to change things as I went, if it felt like it was more opportunity, because a concept artist would work on a concept for a week or 2 weeks or something. But I felt the way I figured is I was working on this thing for like a month. So over the course of that month, if I think of things or ideas that I want to put in there, I'll put them in there. Sometimes they were removed. Sometimes people didn't like it. But oftentimes I was given the ability to kind of make those decisions. And certainly I'd have to make adjustments, especially at the beginning of an art creation of an art asset. I would check in with the art director very frequently so that I wouldn't have to stop and go back seven steps and change this, but once the things are in place after the first like week or something like that, then it just becomes a question of, consolidating forms and cleaning up forms and adding details and that kind of thing. So I would try to figure out early if I was getting something wrong and then try to make those changes early. So, yeah.
Now, Adam Adamowicz was the secret weapon at Bethesda, and you've done a lovely tribute to him on your website, which is cool. I highly advise people to check it out. But what was the number one thing you think you learned from him?
Discipline, I think. It maybe the number one and two thing would be discipline and letting go of your ego. We're probably big ones. I think he was prolific. He would on the bus to work every day, he would sketch in his sketch pad, and then he'd spend all day sketching. And then he even oftentimes sketch during lunch. He wouldn't usually take time off just to hang out with people. Even though he was very, personable, very sociable. And then he would work on the drive home. on the bus home, and then he'd go to the gym, and he'd eat dinner or whatever, and then he'd work on his personal projects. And I think I learned, like, oh, if you want to be like good, like really good, you kind of have to be working on this all the time. And I think that was a wake-up call for me, because I think I always had like kind of a more, I think it's because I started early and stuck with it earlier enough. Drawing and art in general was always like came more naturally to me. But then I think seeing the way he worked made me realize that if I wanted to be not just good but great, I'd have to just work my ass off all the time. And so, and I especially appreciated the kind of letting go of your ego, you know, because when he would make some concept art, it was his job to make five pieces of concept art for every one piece of concept art they actually used, you know? And so all the time he was generating ideas, and a lot of them were getting shot down, and he just wouldn't stagger or anything. He'd just keep on moving on. And that was the job of a concept artist. And so I learned a lot about creativity and the creative process, and what it took to be really, really good from Adam.
Yeah. Well, I suppose when it comes to creatives naturally tend to have an ego. So if you can let go of it, it's a very good thing. And probably a bit more sensitive than maybe the average Joe as well. So, like, how long did it take you to really let the ego go? And was it like an instantaneous thing, or did it take you a while before you
I mean, I
stopped
don't know if
taking it on
I've
board?
I don't know if I've gotten rid of my ego per se.
Well, is it
But
better than it was before? It's like, I mean,
yeah, I think
in terms of letting stuff go.
yeah, I think so. I think you know, I would never, you know, like start a fit or whatever like that. But I, you know, you fall in love with your own ideas, you know,
Of course, yeah.
because they're your ideas, they are what you want to work on, you know, most. I think what helped me is understanding that I was part of a team, and that I was making art that was supposed to serve the larger function, and it had to belong in the game. And so I think that working in a, you know, environment, in a team environment, that it was a production environment, reminded me that after I make this art asset, it's going to go to an animator. And after that, it's going to go into, you know, get plugged in, hooked up to AI, and then designers will work with it, et cetera, et cetera. Recognizing that I was part of a process was helpful to me. And recognizing that there has to be some top-down control of the artistic vision, because that's how you make everything feel cohesive, you know? If you're playing a game and you can tell that like this one art asset doesn't really belong because of the color scheme and the shapes, and maybe it looks more cartoonish than everything around you, it kind of drives you nuts. And so I think that recognizing that you're part of a vision, a larger vision, helped a lot in terms of putting my ideas away. Also, I think that another thing I learned from Adam is, you know, study references a lot and try to derive ideas from there. And so every time I started a piece of art, I would ask Adam what he was looking at, or if it was a different concept artist, I'd ask them too, what it was they were looking at, what it was they were referencing as they made this thing. And the whole idea there was to take what they were looking at and bring it onto my plate, so that I wasn't just inventing things out of my head, because then I'd be creating something kind of ultimately derivative and other ultimately rather samey, because we all tend to like, as you know, similar number of things. So I think recognizing that having other people's influences embedded into mine, or even replacing mine, would force me to work outside of my comfort zone, which would ultimately make me stronger and more capable and more well-rounded.
You're probably aware of like all these layoffs that have been happening in the video game industry. Bethesda seems to fly in the face of that. It's like one of the few Western studios where it seems to have a very high retention rate. Why do you think that is? I mean, you were there, you understand the culture. And there's people that have been there for what, 15, 20 years? Long time. Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, longer than that, you know, 30 years. It was, I think, quite well run. They were very shrewd. The marketing department, you know, helped them put together quite a stockpile of money. They were relatively conservative, I think, moving as they moved forward. But then I think the guy who ran Bethesda, Robert Altman, who was married to Linda Carter, who used to be Wonder Woman, and he passed away a couple years ago. he had empire building on the brain. You know, like he wanted to use the revenues from Bethesda to acquire other studios like id and things like that. And so I think it was recognized that being one of the more successful and money-making game studios in their portfolio, I think they recognize that, I think there's a feeling that like there's, within the umbrella of Bethesda Games, they might jettison a lot of other companies under their umbrella before they get rid of Bethesda Game Studios, because Bethesda was kind of like a, where they put their big bucks, I think, that and id, of course. So there was, there's a certain stability there. I think the culture was really good for a while. You know, I haven't been there for a while, so I can't speak to the culture now. I know it's changed some. But, we all had a kitchen that we all ate lunch at together. You know, we knew the chef. We knew the woman calling our names out when our food was ready. You know, there's a lot of team building, a lot of community building. And I think that played a huge hand into people staying for a while. I think it was also the kind of place where, unfortunately, I think, you can also, once you got there, you could kind of relax and not have to work that hard to keep your job. They don't fire people easily. You know, I think maybe they're leery of getting sued or something like that, but they're just, it's very hard to get fired, I think, at Bethesda. And so I think there was, if you're not working that hard, but you're putting in your hours, you could just kind of do that forever. And I think that's has resulted a little bit in like some people who maybe, well, I won't go that far. I just think it's very easy to go there and kind of cruise because you're not going to lose your job. And so
there'd be like that. There'd be people like that at any company, I think.
Any company.
Yeah.
Any company.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a tale of as old as time. It's human nature.
Yeah.
But I think there's some people, especially of the younger generation of at the time, who I think worked really hard and poured their souls into the game, but weren't necessarily recognized or lauded over kind of everyone else to the degree where I think there was a feeling of like, I think a lot of people who were kind of really pushing for change and for revolutionizing things and always moving forward, I don't know that people felt very supported in that environment. And so some of those people moved on, and the people who didn't have to put in all that time and just kind of get their head down, they could just stay. And so, listen, what I'm saying is a broad and rather ugly generalization. You know, it's verging on slanderous, and so I apologize in advance for like kind of coming off, that way. But, when you're in a company, any company, any organization, and you feel change is happening and you're not happy with how kind of, things are being handled in some respects, you kind of build up these small grudges, these kind of, you start to see the bad patterns and things. And so if you're hearing negativity in my voice, it simply comes from the fact of just working there for years and not being entirely happy with how certain things were getting managed. And a lot of my colleagues have left since then, I think there is so much potential at that game studio, and there's a lot of new hires there who are young and hungry and amazing dreamers, and I really look forward to seeing what they do with Elder Scrolls 6. I really cannot wait.
It's still a long way away.
Exactly. And I think there's just a lot of people there who I remember who like didn't work that hard, who are just still there, and who will never leave. And so I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
What was the dynamic you had with Todd Howard? Did you have much of a dynamic with him?
Oh yeah. Yeah. He's a very playful guy.
Very charismatic guy.
Yeah. He's charismatic. It's hard to say. He's a tricky guy to navigate. He is very charismatic, but I think in many ways, if you're the guy in charge, you're a little bit alone, like it's you alone, you're the captain, and so everyone can be tight with the captain. They can be loyal to the captain. It's hard to really be friends with the captain because there's not because of,
yeah,
of anything other than like he's authority, and his word has to go. And I think that one thing that I felt really good about in the years while I was there, and I only agreed with maybe 65% of the decisions he made in general. But I think that's a very high batting average for a leader. I mean, think about like presidential approval numbers, right? Like, you know, like when you have to make, when there's some guy at the top making all the decisions, like you're not going to agree with a lot of them.
No.
But I will say that I think me at the time of Fallout and Skyrim and all that, I think there was a general feeling whether or not you were angry at Todd or annoyed at Todd or whatever. I don't think there was ever any feeling like anybody else should be in charge. And I think that's a huge deal. That's a huge deal, as I think that if, you know, I fundamentally knew that this was going to go well because Todd was in charge. And that's a feeling of profound security, you know? So, yeah, so he and I were great. We've always been great. The last time I saw him was at my producer Angela's wedding, actually. And he got a little toasty and he told me that everybody there misses me. And if I wanted to come back, I can come back. Now, listen, this was years ago. So, you know, does the offer still stand? I don't know. I have no idea.
Who knows? Yeah, yeah.
I haven't seen him in like 8 years or something like that. But yeah, no, he was great. And he was always complimentary and supportive of my work. And I only really got my nose, like, you know, bopped by him like once in any kind of significant way, and I deserved it. So, you know, like, yeah, he is, you know, I don't know. Again, I don't know how things have gone now. I know the company's changed and it's gotten bigger and all these different things have happened. So I don't know. I can't speak to him now, but at the time I worked with him, you know, I'll say this. When I got hired there, we had about like 54 people on the team. Small. It was very small.
That's
so I got
tiny.
To know him really, really well. Oh, yeah, it was tiny. By the time I left, it was only like 110. So it was still tiny. And so I think I got to know Todd, not at the beginning necessarily, by any stretch of the imagination, but it was still a small and intimate team where everyone knew each other. And so as the company's changed, I think his role within the company has changed. I think there's not probably that same sense of connectivity at everything. Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if maybe he felt, you know, a little sour about me leaving, because I think when you're the guy in charge and you're trying to run things as well as you can, and then you have someone like me kind of tell him like, I'm leaving, you know, like got to go, you know, especially after a hit like Skyrim, I got to imagine you feeling like, if it was me, I'd be like a little bit bitter. I'd be like, why you leave, man? Like we had a good thing going, you know,
and
we did have a good thing going. We really did. We had a beautiful thing going during the time I was there.
He would understand that, surely. I mean, you would have told him the reasons as to why you're going.
Of course.
So there'd probably be a part of him that's bitter, but then probably another part
absolutely
that would understand. Yeah.
Absolutely. No. I mean, when I told him I was leaving and taking a year off and writing a fantasy novel and all that, he was like, dude, I want to do that. And I looked at him. I said, I know, man, but you can't. Like you're actually stuck here. Like you actually cannot leave at all. And so I think that I think he really understood where I was coming from. I think he really did. But, you know, it's like, again, like he's stuck there. So, you know, why wouldn't he feel like, you know, well, if I'm stuck here, like we should be here together. You know, I think he works really hard to build a team. I think over the years, it's hard to build a team and have people constantly leaking away at the edges. And, you know, after a while you start to feel, you know, listen, I'm completely guessing as to his psychology, but again, I think it's lonely at the top, you know?
Yeah, it is. Did you have like a newfound appreciation for him once you went off and you worked on Fireborn? Was it Fireborn?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Fireborn, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, he, his ability to say no was one I wish I had embraced much earlier in the years afterwards. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think building games like Skyrim, they seem limitless, and Fallout, they seem limitless. They seem huge. They seem impossibly huge. But actually, like, to do that, to pull that off, the guy at the top really has to say no a lot to a lot of ideas, to the point where it was frustrating and annoying. And there's projects I worked on after hours just to get them in the game. And by and large, they got in the game, which is great. But it was very clear to me that I could not work on whatever I kind of dreamed up at that time at work all the time, because we had a game to get through and we had the fundamentals to hit. And so, yeah, certainly. I think he had a very strong sense of what the games we were working on were and what they had to be and what they weren't and what they didn't have to be. And he would very quickly say no to anything that didn't fit within that paradigm. And that by definition, that's very limiting. But you know, he had a great quote that we went over a lot, which is, "We can do everything. I'm sorry, we can do anything, but we can't do everything." And so the idea is, it's a game. We can make the game do whatever we want, but it can only do a certain number of things. And so that has stuck with me, I think. Yeah, that focus on the core experience has stuck with me.
I mean, there's some concern, I suppose, that when the day comes when he hangs up the gloves, so to speak, like who will be able to take the mantle from him, you know?
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I think at a certain point it, you know, I'm a big fan of changing up your career, you know, as is evidenced by my ever-changing career. And so I think when the day comes for him to hang up his gloves, it'll be a good day. Not because he doesn't still have it or whatever, but I think that, like, you know, going from one game to the next is exhausting. And if you have to helm that game and see it through every single step of the way, that's exhausting. So on the one hand, I'm like, dude, this dude was born to do this. Mm. On the other hand, I'm like, I don't know, he's like 50 something at this point, and like he's been doing this hardcore now for like what, 25 years, like being not just working games but being at the helm of them, you know. Yeah. It's you know, I think the day he hangs up his gloves, there's going to be a lot of stumbling and staggering by whoever reassumes that responsibility, for sure.
Mm.
But you know, even if I was the guy who came up with the Elder Scrolls, you know, and like invented, you know, and then made Elder Scrolls games, I feel like Elder Scrolls like 3 or whatever, I would just have to leave. I'd be done. Like, someone else do the, I'm all done. I can't, I got to pick it up. I got to do something completely different.
Well, maybe that's why that's why you alternated between Fallout and Elder Scrolls, right? So you don't find it too tedious.
Well, I think, unfortunately, I think that may have been what happened between Fallout 4 and Fallout 76 is Fallout 76 was a decision made near the top. I think maybe even outside of Todd's control, maybe. And it was like, this Fallout thing has got legs. Let's keep it moving. And if I'd been there from the Fallout 4 to Fallout 76 transition, I think about this sometimes. I literally would have refused. I would have been like, no, I will work on Elder Scrolls 6 in secret for the next 3 years until the rest of the team is ready to move on to that. Because I can't keep doing dented metal and rusted out, you know, everything. And I can't keep doing irradiated monsters all the time. I want to make something beautiful. I want to make something wondrous. I want to, you know, give me respite from like the same subject matter.
And the other thing is, because games are taking longer to make, you'd actually be spending even more time working on it than previously.
Yeah. No, I mean, being a game designer, it means measuring your life by projects. You know, you only have like, you know, 7 projects in you, you know, with each one taking like 3 years or whatever. You can only do that like a certain number of times before you're just old and you have to, you know, you have to stop working and maybe start dying soon because life's only so short, you know what I mean? And so you only get so many, you know, cracks at these big projects. So certainly, yeah, with games getting bigger and bigger, you measure your life in terms of the projects you've created.
Mm. What did you think of the Fallout TV adaptation, by the way?
Loved it.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Brilliant, right?
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. I was really tickled by it. I think they did a really beautiful job. I think Fallout is very hard to get right. A lot of people have tried. A lot of people can capture the general flavor of it, all these different things. There's a lot of aspects of it that people get. But I think if you're going to do a full-blown 8 or 10 episode, whatever it was, arc within the Fallout universe, and you're trying to layer by layer explain the world of Fallout, that which came before and how things are standing now, it's complicated. And I think they nailed it. They got the politics of the 1950s, you know, like they really nailed the politics and like the worldview of like that, like imperialist America, the jingoism, the nationalism, the commercialism, the like highly militarized, you know, near dictator state of America was brilliantly captured and effortlessly rendered. I think the art direction was awesome. I thought that I really, really appreciated that they actually really cut down on the number of things they tried to cover. You know, no mention of super mutants. You know, the Enclave was simply mentioned and that was it. Lots of monsters they didn't show. Lots of places they didn't go. They really kept it to a certain number of core story principles. And I think that's why it succeeded, is it didn't try to do everything. And I just loved it. And I think also the last thing I'll say is that I felt, as a developer and as somebody who has handled that material myself, I felt quite respected by the show, because they just seemed to take entire art assets out of the games and putting them in the show. It was like they weren't trying to start from scratch and they weren't trying to invent their own thing. They loved the subject matter and they wanted to do justice to it, and that showed. And so I am really grateful that the people who worked on that show did such a good job.
Mm. Best video game adaptation of all time so far, by a mile.
It might be.
I think so.
I think you may be right. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made for Last of Us, but I think Last of Us, it's almost...
There was a direct translation.
That was a direct translation. That's exactly right. And beyond like the zombies themselves, like there, it was a pretty straightforward human story of survival. It wasn't like, you know, the world of The Last of Us is not as dramatic and bold and strange and uniquely defined as the world of Fallout. The world of Fallout is a world. It's like a, you know, you're selling a place, a time, a feel, a humor, and all these things. And they translated it beautifully into a whole new story.
I know we're going a little bit over time, but there were two questions I wanted to...
That's all right. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, the first one is, you've mentioned before that Bethesda doesn't really have an iconic art style, right? And it might... a signature art style, I should say.
Yeah.
And that was brought on by the limitations of the engine. But how hard is it to make a very signature art style when you're using like realistic graphics as opposed to stylized graphics?
Yeah, I think it's much harder. I think it's much harder to pull it off. Yeah, so when I say it doesn't have much of an art style, that's not a knock on Bethesda at all.
No,
generally what they go for is realism. Yeah, they generally go for realism. And so that's kind of the art style. Now, you can talk about art direction, and they have strong art direction. You know, the worlds they build are very convincing. The world of Fallout 3 is utterly unlike the world of Oblivion, even though they're made using the same engine more or less, and all the same artists more or less, etc. But in terms of like art style, yeah, you look at something like Dota or Diablo, or you know, basically any, you know, World of Warcraft game. There's a much cleaner, more slick style going on in games like Valorant and things like that, where it's very cartoonish and slick and bright and colorful. And, you know, so Bethesda does not embrace those kinds of styles. But again, those have a very particular aesthetic and they work within their own world. And so, yeah, I think I certainly never felt like we had a set style per se. We were just trying to capture a world, I guess,
Do you personally prefer realism or stylized?
I think I personally prefer realism. But I think that's because it's kind of all I know, really. I've tried to work really hard working backwards on my own work, trying to make it more, I'm always aiming to try to make it more simple and make it more stylized. And I have only limited success because I'm kind of constantly trying to figure out how things are really working. And so...
Well, I suppose you can have stylized realism as well. It's not like it's one or the other. Yeah.
And I think that's how I would describe my game art personally, is like a stylized realism where I don't even know how to describe my style per se. It's me going for realism that's also like kind of hyper dramatic kind of, but yeah, you can, for sure you can. Yeah. And I think the best, you know, media and all that is exactly that. It's a realistic stylization. Yeah.
Now, obviously we have to talk about your fantasy novel, Quiet.
Yeah.
How did you come up with the name Quiet, by the way?
Good question. I'm not sure. I think it came about because I had done a lot of pictures of this small little skeleton. And in the summer of 2020, when the world was terrible and everything, I decided I wanted to do like, kind of some kind of short form media that was very comforting, that felt like chicken soup for the soul. And so I made these videos called The Story of Quiet, in which I had this little skeleton named Quiet. And the name just kind of fit. It, you know, it fit their very diminutive stature. It seemed to fit their personality. And it just kind of clicked. And also visually as a character, Quiet doesn't have is a skeleton with no lower jaw. And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, well, I thought to myself, can they even speak really? So it started off as a kind of a nice name that kind of seemed to fit the mood of the character. And then, since I've created Quiet Level One, which is the graphic novel I'm working on at the moment, which is on Kickstarter, once I really started digging into the story, I realized to myself, truly, actually, Quiet shouldn't be able to speak. And that seemed to me more interesting, actually, and more compelling than having them be able to speak, because it adds a certain mystery. It adds a certain unusual quality. You know, they're kind of a vaguely cartoonish looking skeleton, and there's lots of non-speaking characters in video games and this and that, but having this actually be a feature of their character seemed like a very interesting challenge to me, you know, where I have my villain and he's monologuing, and I have the villain's, you know, sidekick who's like this black knife with an eye in it, and he's always scheming and snarling about this or that. And then you have Quiet's friend, the narrator worm, who is a small species of caterpillar who narrates everything from Quiet's perspective or the perspective of whoever it's with at the time. And then you have Quiet, and Quiet is just silent and speaks to you through body language, acting, and action. And I thought that was that made for a compelling centerpiece, I thought, you know, this small diminutive character who can't even share to you their backstory. You know, who knows if their name is even Quiet? You know, Quiet is what we end up calling them, but they don't necessarily, you know, it's like one of those things where they don't actually even have a name. So yeah.
Did most of those ideas be there from the start, or was it one of those things where it just evolved over time?
The very first snapshot I got of Quiet is when I started doing this painting of a skeleton standing in a dungeon. It was a small skeleton with a big belly and a really big noggin, wearing old corroded armor, holding a tiny little sword and having a torch. And the skeleton is looking around, and it looks very unhappy. It looks scared. And the whole premise of the cartoon was like, what if like these undead skeleton warriors? What if there's a really small one who's afraid of the dark? You know, and that was kind of a cute, funny, silly little idea to me. And it started there, but really the idea of this little skeleton warrior or like skeleton sentry or whatever it is came from like Diablo 2, where I think about being the barbarian and storming into like, you know, the catacombs of level one and just walking around demolishing skeletons left and right. And these skeletons are too dumb to even attack you until you get right up close to them. They kind of just wander aimlessly. And I thought to myself, well, what if they were just chilling? What if they were just minding the damn business, you know, and you are the psychopath running down there, wrecking them one by one by one. And you're this, you know, when you play the barbarian in Diablo, it's designed to be a power trip. You know, he's basically just like a mech, you know, he just goes in and wrecks everything, and it's meant to make you feel powerful. And so I started thinking more and more about like, well, what if the villain of, what if that hero is actually the villain? He thinks he's the hero, but he's the villain. He's Conan, but evil, right? And he's just like walking in and laying waste to these populations of creatures that like, actually, they're not evil at all. He just doesn't understand them. And when it comes to like a skeleton like Quiet, like he couldn't even speak to Quiet if he wanted to, if he cared to, you know? And so I think the universe started life as this matchup of a level one skeleton versus a level 100 barbarian. That is compelling to me, because if the hero is the level one skeleton, the question is, how the hell are they going to win? You know, like everyone knows a level one skeleton can't do crap against a level 100 barbarian. And so but immediately that idea hooked me. And then from there, the next step was, you know, I had the who and I had the what, the two of them going against each other. And the where was then the last big piece, which is the Tree of Worlds. And the Tree of Worlds is something that we're familiar with from the Tree of Life, Yggdrasil from Norse mythology. Whether or not we're familiar with it intimately, we know the idea of, you know, a tree with all these kind of different worlds where different gods live, you know, in the trees. But I thought, well, what if you paired that with that video game idea so that you had this Tree of Worlds, but it was divided into levels, level one, level two, level three, and every level is its own landscape, you know, with its own environment and its own bosses and treasures and NPCs and quest lines and all these things. But what if the goal then is for the villain to get to the top and the hero has to stop him from getting to the top?
Hmm.
Well, now we've come up with like the who, the what, and the where in a huge way. And so, you know, once I had the characters and I had the location, I immediately had a sense of, you know, the moment you see that tree with all the levels, you immediately are thinking progression, escalation, and, you know, escalation, you know, and even saying, calling it quiet level one, it's a promise. This is going to go up from here. You know, this is only the beginning because this is a, you know, a journey. And so those are the fundamental pieces that I think were there for a while. And then I've let the other pieces simmer for a while before clicking into place.
Mm. Well, I look forward to seeing it, you know.
I look forward to showing it.
Yeah. So it's available on Kickstarter.
That's right.
And Everyone can keep track of it there, or I suppose on your social media feeds, and you got a YouTube channel and everything as well.
Oh yeah, totally. I'm posting about it on Instagram and on Twitter. I've got videos on it on my YouTube channel, and you should absolutely check it out. It's I'm pouring everything I have into it. All the work that I put into Skyrim and Fallout and all that attention and love that I put into those things, I'm putting into this, except even more so because this is my personal project. And we're about 10 days in, 9 days in, and it's going great. We have over 1,100 backers. We just hit 100,000 yesterday. So that means that the final product is getting upgraded, you know, more deluxe hardcovers. We're getting extra enamel pins for people at different levels. I'm working on the Tree of Worlds, like world map right now. There's a lot of things going down and it's very exciting. So yeah, if you're listening, come check it out. At least watch it for the trailer and see. Check out
the
trailer.
The trailer's really good.
Thank you.
That's
I'm
a cool
really,
trailer.
Really
Yeah. Was that your idea, or did you work with someone else to bring that in terms of how you did the trailer?
I did. It was my idea. And I worked closely with a couple other people. I worked with my friend from high school, this guy Tony.
Nice.
And another guy named Jeffrey Palmer that I met kind of on Twitter, who's he's really well known for animating Marvel. Magic cards, doing animations of Magic cards. And they worked together to make the little trailer of Quiet Level One, the movie. And then I worked with a guy named Nathaniel Dotson, who I knew from my days streaming for Adobe. He runs tutvid.com, which is a tutorial video. And that's like a website, a YouTube channel with 1.5 million followers. He's awesome. And he met me at this movie theater in Pennsylvania to shoot the footage for the trailer. For the Kickstarter video. And so it was really cool. It was very much a collaborative effort. I kind of had masterminded it, storyboarded everything out, but I worked closely with these other people. I listened to their feedback, you know, in some circumstances where I preferred, you know, these tracks over these tracks. I, you know, over the tracks chosen by my video editor, I chose to let my video editor take the lead. Cause I'm like, I want you to be excited about this. I want this to feel good for you. And that's how I'm going to get the best out of you, because, you know, spoiler alert, when you're an independent artist, you don't have a lot of money to give out. And so when your friends agree to help you, you know, out of the kindness of their heart, you know, you let them take the creative control they need to get the best out of them. So it was great. I felt very supported. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jonah, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time out of your afternoon. I suppose it's evening there, and you can go have some dinner now.
Thank you. Yeah.
But I appreciate you doing this, and all the best, and I'll be keeping an eye out on Quiet.
Great. Level one. Thank you so much, Reese, and thank you to everybody listening.
Yeah. All right, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe, and until next time, stay safe.